This week's addendum is brought to you by Stamps.com. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like this podcast. So why are you still dealing with limited hours at the post office when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer whenever you need it, 24/7. Right now, use a promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You get a 4-week trial, plus $110 bonus offer, includes up to $55 in free postage. Go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter undisclosed. Once again, that's stamps.com, and enter undisclosed. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed, and this week's addendum, Exhibit 31. My name is Rabia Jadhri. I'm an attorney and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com, and I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Vocal Blog Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs The View from LL2, and Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Now, first, I would like to thank our listeners for their patience. I know our last episode release was late due to circumstances outside of our control, and this week's release has also been delayed, but this time we did it on purpose. Now, as you know, much of our work is focused on figuring out what happened nearly 17 years ago, and week after week, that's what we bring to you. But also, this is an active case. Things are happening right now in the courts, things that could help lead to a new trial for Adnan. So this week's addendum was timed to correspond to an important filing in the case, Adnan's response to the state's brief a few weeks ago, which actually asked the court to dismiss his petition to reopen the appeal hearing and include Asia's testimony. Now, all of these filings and pleadings are important, of course, but this time, along with the Asia issue, Adnan's response will put a major issue and piece of the state's evidence to bed from a source you never expected.
Earlier today, Justin Brown, Adnan's attorney, filed his response to the state's own response to his motion to reopen Adnan's PCR petition in circuit court. And Susan, before we get to the heart of what we're going to discuss in this case, the heart of that response, there are a couple of interesting additions that Justin has added to his response. And what's the first of those?
Well, in addition to discussing the state's Strickland argument regarding Asia, Adnan's reply brief discusses, for instance, the library issue. As you'll recall, one of the issues that came up in Adnan's original PCR hearing was whether or not the library was part of the school campus. According to the state in their recent brief, the fact that Asia says that Adnan was at the public library means that he was not telling the truth about having stayed on campus from the time period after school until track practice. Of course, there's a basic problem with that argument from the beginning, Colin, which is that Adnan never actually said that.
Yeah, we've looked to the citations in the state's brief where they claim that Adnan told the detectives and the police officers that he remained on the school campus, and he never said that. Those citations are wrong. Simply put, there's no evidence whatsoever that Adnan ever said he remained in the school campus.
At least to a police officer. The only reference I've ever seen to that statement comes from Gutierrez's own alibi document, the one with the 80-odd witnesses, which says, at the conclusion of the school day, the defendant remained at the high school until the beginning of his track practice. After track practice, Adnan said went home and remained there. Now, as we've also discussed previously, this is not a statement from Adnan. It's not his own words.
Yeah, on this point, Maryland's case law is clear. An alibi notice per se is not at all relevant or admissible to show a defendant's own version of the events that transpired on the date in question. It's just a discovery tool. It's where an attorney lays out, this might be an alibi defense we're presenting at trial. And here's notice to you, the prosecution, of what we might present, but it is not at all any evidence of the defendant's own thinking or telling of what happened on the day in question.
And again, as far as we can tell, and as far as we've seen anywhere on the record, it's the only reference to Adnan saying he stayed at school the entire school day. But as Chris's affidavit makes clear, And as has been made clear in Serial and through other witnesses' statements, the library was part of the school campus. It was across a parking lot. It was next door. And the fact that a Woodlawn student would have said, "I stayed on campus all day," would not have precluded the student going to the library. And the way that term was used and the way the student spoke, it would have been understood that he could have been on the track field, he could have been the gym, he could have been the library. So Asia's alibi was not made useless or didn't contradict a non-story simply because Anon said or allegedly said that he stayed at school the entire day. To accompany Anon's reply brief, there's an affidavit from Krista. Krista was a student at Woodlawn. She was a friend of both Anon and Hay. And she states in her affidavit that for a Woodlawn student to say that they stayed on campus, that could easily mean they were at the gym, at the track field, or at the public library, which was across the parking lot, and in the same area as the school. Technically, it was a public library. It was not the school library, but the students used it as an extension of their campus and were frequently there. So even though Anon never actually said that he stayed at school all day after school ended, if he had said that, the fact that he was also at the library would not be a contradiction. Therefore, Asia's alibi was not made useless or harmful to Anon's case based on any alleged statement that he'd been at the library. I mean, and if you want another example of why the library was in fact part of the Woodlawn campus, when the police, during the initial investigation, pulled up a copy of all records of police incidences at the Woodlawn High School, that report also pulled up every incident that occurred at the Woodlawn Public Library. In other words, for the police purposes, a list of incidences that occurred at Woodlawn High School also included any incidences that occurred at the Woodlawn Public Library. In addition to the Krista affidavit, another affidavit accompanying the brief came from an attorney who worked with Gutierrez. She was familiar with Gutierrez's work and how things were done in her office, and according to her, any attempt to use that 80-witness alibi notice that was filed by Gutierrez in Anon's case as proof that Gutierrez investigated those alibis or had actually investigated any alibi claim at all would be a misuse of the document. According to her, it would just be a notice. It would not imply that any kind of investigation went in to those names, which we can also tell from the fact that the witnesses on that list were not actually contacted by Gutierrez and did not include witnesses that should have been on it, such as Coach Tsai. So again, this list doesn't even include witnesses that Gutierrez actually called at Anon's trial to provide an alibi. So calling this a complete list of alibis is patently false.
Having laid out these preliminary points, let's now turn to the heart of this response. It's this really interesting new argument that Adnan's attorney is making. And to set the stage for that, let's look at some language from the opinion of the Court of Appeals of Maryland. This is its case, Dashiell versus Meeks. According to the court, judicial estoppel is defined as a principle that precludes a party from taking a position in a subsequent action inconsistent with a position taken by him or her in a previous action. The purpose behind this doctrine of judicial estoppel was eloquently explained in Kramer versus Globe Brewing Company. If parties in court were permitted to assume inconsistent positions in the trial of their causes, the usefulness of courts of justice would in most cases be paralyzed. Now, we start this discussion with this language because everything we're about to talk about started with the state trying to argue a position inconsistent with the position it took at Adnan's trial back in 2000. And even if the doctrine of judicial estoppel doesn't technically apply to this new argument, we now know the state itself has consistently made other arguments that, if true, would, without question, support granting Adnan a new trial. The only way a new trial shouldn't be granted based upon what we're about to discuss is if the state can convince the court that its prior arguments were wrong. In other words, a new trial should be granted unless the state is allowed to argue against itself. Having said that, where do we begin? Let's start all the way back with Adnan's trial in 2000.
To examine the state's position back at the time of Anand's trial, we'll look at the closing arguments. For instance, in closing, Prosecutor Casey Murphy told the jury the following. We know that class ended at 2:15 that day. And remember back to Aisha Pittman's testimony. The defendant was talking to Hay Lee at that point in time, and Ines Butler sees Hay as she rushes out of school, grabs her snack, and heads out the door. Ladies and gentlemen, she's dead within 20 minutes. 2:36 p.m., the defendant calls Jay Wilds, come get me, at Best Buy. Jay Wilds is at the home of Jennifer Pusateri. This statement is why Aisha McClain is such a crucial alibi witness. Aisha says that she saw Anand at the Woodlawn Public Library until 2:40 p.m., while the state claims that Anand was calling Jay from the Best Buy about a mile down the road from where the library was at 2:36 p.m., having already killed Hay in the parking lot. In other words, both things can't be true. If Aisha's testimony is correct, then the state's case could not have happened. Recognizing that this created an opening for the importance of Aisha's testimony, the state made a very bold claim in its recent brief before the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland. According to the state, the problem with this logic of this argument is that the state could have worked off the also tenable assumption that it was the 22nd 3:15 p.m. call and not the earlier 2:36 p.m. call that corresponded to Syed's call to Wilds to come meet him. In other words, had McClain testified that she and Syed were sending emails or talking to one another at the Woodlawn Library until 2:40 p.m., that would have presented a relevant alibi on only one of two possible timelines the state could have argued to the jury. Both calls were short and originated from an unspecified number. Either of them could have been presented by the state as a key communication from Syed to Wilds, and neither timeline was more or less consistent with the remainder of the state's case. To be clear, the point is not that the state's asserted timeline was flawed, but only that Syed overstates the significance of Aisha McClain. At most, McClain would have, like Debbie and Syed's father, added a modest wrinkle to the possible timelines of the crime. This too underscores why Syed has not established prejudice as a result of the alleged failure to pursue Aisha McClain. In other words, the TLDR here is that the state could have chosen whatever timeline it wanted, so having an alibi would not have helped Anand. They simply would have shifted their story and argued a different timeline, one that didn't cover a time period that Aisha could account for.
Yeah, and I know, Susan, when I read this, as someone who's involved with the law, I was pretty shocked by the argument so glibly claim, we said she was killed by 2:36 p.m. and that's the call, but we just as easily could have shifted the timeline and said it was 3:15, and that doesn't show the weakness in our case. I mean, for me, it clearly does show the weakness of the case. The point being that Jay testified at trial, the call wasn't until after 3:45 p.m., and so, yes, it's true, it could have worked with 2:36 and 3:15, but that's only because your key witness for the prosecution is contradicting either of those calls. That was my response as someone involved in the law, but I sort of overwhelmed by the response by listeners and people on Twitter, just completely shocked that the state would make this argument and really show how there was basically nothing to the state's case. It was all smoke and mirrors.
Plus, I don't even buy the claim that the state's argument could have worked with the 3:15 timeline, because the biggie, I guess, to corroborate Jay's story from the cell records is the Nisha call. And if we're going with the 3:15 timeline, the Nisha call could not have been made by Anand. So sure, the state could have shifted its timeline and make the come and get me call 3:15. But that would have severely harmed its case in that, one, it couldn't explain the Nisha call. Two, it couldn't explain why their calls to Jen the second Jay gets the come and get me call. Three, it couldn't explain, well, it never could explain in the first place, but it would have new troubles in explaining Jay's convoluted story of what happened after they left the Best Buy. So yeah, again, they could have shifted it, but there were problems with that, and neither version is supported by evidence in the first place. Even if Gutierrez hadn't known about the time of the murder, or at least the state's theory of the time of the murder, and prior to Anand's first trial, did not investigate Aisha McClain based on a belief that the 2:20 to 2:40 timeline was unimportant and would not help Anand's case, after the first trial, when the state did put forth this timeline, she was fully aware of what the crucial time period was. And at that point, if she had not done so already, she had no excuse to not contact Aisha McClain.
Yeah, and if we go back to what I led this section with, there's an argument that the state here is in fact judicially stopped from making this argument at all because it's inconsistent with its trial position. There's also an argument that this was an entirely new argument the state advanced on appeal and that they couldn't make this argument for the first time on appeal. If we look, though, this is the response by Adnan's attorney. It was not just to make arguments like that, it was to file a supplement. And that supplement was basically arguing, okay, the state, if they're not allowed to argue what they could have but didn't argue back in 2000, then I should be able to argue what defense counsel could have argued in response to this argument that was never made at trial. And more specifically, in this supplement filed by Adnan's attorney, he's saying, if you're going to argue we could have placed all this emphasis on the 3:15 p.m. call at trial and say that could have been the Best Buy call, then I should be able to argue that Gutierrez could have attacked any aspect of that call. And one of those aspects, of course, is the cell tower that 3:15 p.m. call pinged.
This led to Adnan's attorney arguing what we discussed in a previous undisclosed episode, that an AT&T cover sheet clearly stated that incoming calls are not reliable for determining location. According to Adnan's attorney, Gutierrez could have used this cover sheet at a Frye hearing back in 2000 to have the evidence concerning the towers pinged by incoming calls, such as the 3:15 p.m. call and the 709 7:16 p.m. calls from Lincoln Park, allegedly, deemed inadmissible at trial.
Yeah, and you might recall from our prior episode, a Frye hearing is a pretrial hearing where the judge determines whether scientific and expert evidence is reliable and admissible, or on the other hand, unreliable and inadmissible. So the argument here being, based upon the clear language of this cover sheet, the judge would have used this cover sheet to conclude the incoming pings were inadmissible at trial.
The state's response to this argument was rather aggressive. First, the state claimed that the cover sheet, by its own terms, applied only to subscriber activity reports. Second, the state claimed that the cell phone records admitted in Adnan's trial in Exhibit 31 were not subscriber activity reports, and therefore the AT&T cover sheet did not apply to them. Third, the state claimed that it hadn't actually introduced any subscriber activity reports at Adnan's trial, and therefore if Gutierrez had tried to raise hell over the incoming call records based on the cover sheet, she would have looked foolish and disingenuous.
Yeah, so this is what I would label the first key position that was advanced by the state that clearly supports a new trial for Adnan, that Gutierrez and by implication Adnan's current attorney had no reason whatsoever to believe Exhibit 31 was a subscriber activity report, and therefore no reason whatsoever to believe the cover sheet was at all relevant to trial or appeal. And in fact, the word subscriber activity report do not appear anywhere on Exhibit 31. We know this because after reading the state's response, Adnan's attorney got a copy of that exhibit from the state, and those words were not listed in the document. However, thereafter, what we were able to find after cross-referencing some other documents with Exhibit 31 was that there's a reason that the word subscriber activity report were missing. That's because back in 2000, the state failed to include the first page of the report that made up Exhibit 31. It's on that first page where the report is referred to as a subscriber activity report. So contrary both to what was shown in Exhibit 31 back in 2000, and contrary to the state's claim as late as a few weeks ago, Exhibit 31, the reports in there are in fact a subscriber activity report.
Let's break that down a bit. To explain what Exhibit 31 is, let's go back to the initial investigation and to the cell phone records that were obtained by Detectives Ritz and McGillivary. On February 18th, in response to a subpoena, AT&T printed out cell phone records for a non-cell phone from January 9th to February 18th. Those records were then faxed to Detective Ritz on February 22nd, and what I will be referring to as the February 22nd fax. The February 22nd fax consisted of an AT&T cover sheet and then 20-odd pages of those cell phone records that were printed out on the 18th. The records included things like the numbers of outgoing calls, the duration of all calls, the times of the calls, and the cell sites that the calls were made on. The very last three pages of this document consisted of the call records from January 9th to January 14th. Now, Adnan only got his cell phone on January 12th, so the first 3 days of those records, January 9th, 10th, and 11th, have no records associated with them. They're just blanks on the page, although the dates are listed. What the state did was take these last three pages from the February 22nd fax and had these authenticated by AT&T, and then it had them marked as Exhibit 31 and used at trial. This means that Exhibit 31 came directly from the fax sent by AT&T and directly from the document that was prefaced by an AT&T cover sheet saying incoming calls aren't reliable. Now, this document was partially produced to the defense. Gutierrez did have a copy of the February 22nd fax, minus the cover sheet. In other words, she had the entire list of records. She had the first page saying subscriber activity, and then all the records from February 18th to January 9th. But what she was not given was the cover sheet saying that subscriber activity reports are not reliable for incoming calls. In other words, Gutierrez never had any way of knowing that this document, which became Exhibit 31, had been produced to the state with a fax cover sheet saying the records were not reliable. Now, she did have a copy of the AT&T cover sheet, but it was not the same cover sheet that was sent on February 22nd, and it was not in context with the Exhibit 31 documents. So she never had a chance to know that the cover sheet did apply to the Exhibit 31 records because the state never told her that.
Yeah, and this is why this is what I labeled the first key position taken by the state. Procedurally, Adnan had to file his post-conviction review petition by 2010. Arguments not raised at that point typically could not be raised thereafter. This deadline, though, does not apply to quote-unquote new evidence that could not have been discovered through due diligence. Well, what we know now is that as late as a few weeks ago, the state, the party who actually had the subscriber activity report from AT&T that formed that basis for Exhibit 31, it didn't know what it had. And it was making arguments that the defense not only couldn't raise this argument, but shouldn't raise this argument because they'd look ridiculous. And so basically the only way that this is not construed as new evidence is if the state comes forward and basically argues against itself and says, well, yeah, we did argue in our brief that this was not a subscriber activity report, but you should have known despite the fact that we didn't know when we're the only ones who had this initial report that came from AT&T.
It looks to me like the state now in 2015 blundered into its own trap that it set back in 2000. Because in 2000, the state carefully separated the AT&T records from the cover sheet and produced them in a form so that Gutierrez could never know that the AT&T cover sheet came with those records and that those records were also subscriber activity reports to which the fax cover applied. 15 years later, in 2015, the state today, writing its brief, was unable to determine what these records were or where they came from. As a result of their unorthodox use of documents and the failure to label them clearly, the state itself couldn't figure out that it was looking at a subscriber activity report, which means that any claim they try to make now that says Gutierrez should have realized it seems, well, disingenuous at best. It seems like the state in general with its briefs is trying to walk an untenable middle ground here because one of two things are going on. Either one, Gutierrez had the cover sheet, knew it applied to the cell phone records used at trial, and then failed to raise it to try and discredit them. Or else, two, the state never actually disclosed to Gutierrez that the fax cover sheet applied to those records and that incoming calls were not considered reliable. It's one or the other. Either what happened here falls afoul of Strickland and Gutierrez was ineffective, or it falls afoul of Brady and the state didn't produce evidence that was constitutionally required produced. Because if Gutierrez had known about it, she was ineffective for not arguing it. And if she didn't know about it, the state was constitutionally depriving Adnan of due process by failing to provide that information to the defense.
Yeah, and once again, this is now a new Brady claim. And you might recall we've discussed Brady before. There's a Brady violation if the state fails to disclose what's called material exculpatory evidence. And again, evidence is material when it undermines your confidence in the jury's verdict or would have created a reasonable probability of a different outcome if it had been disclosed at trial. So here the claim is pretty simple. By the state's own admission, Gutierrez at trial had no reason to use the AT&T cover sheet. If, on the other hand, the state had included the first page of the report that became Exhibit 31, in that case, Gutierrez could have used that cover sheet to have the incoming calls deemed inadmissible at a Frye hearing. Because, in fact, Exhibit 31 consisted of a subscriber activity report. Question then becomes, legally speaking, how should the court evaluate this claim? Well, the good news here is there's no need to guess because Maryland, in fact, has set forth a very crystal clear test. You might recall in the Crime Stoppers episode, we discussed the Supreme Court case of Kyles versus Whitley. That was a Brady case involving the state's failure to disclose several things, including a Crime Stoppers tip and reward. Well, in its 1997 opinion in Ware versus State, the Court of Appeals of Maryland quoted to Kyles versus Whitley and concluded that the likely damage of the state's suppression of evidence in this case is best understood by taking the word of the prosecutor during closing argument. Now, this isn't the only time that Maryland's highest court has cited this language. In fact, it's cited it on two other occasions, again, making it abundantly clear what is said by the prosecution during closing arguments is the best evidence we have of materiality under Brady. So that takes us back to 2000. It takes us back to the closing arguments made during Adnan's trial. And this is what I would label the second key position advanced by the state that unabashedly supports a new trial for Adnan in this case.
Again, look at what Murphy argued in closing arguments. She placed great importance on the cell phone pings, and in particular, the Lincoln Park pings, which were based on incoming calls. She said, at the 7 o'clock hour, the defendants go to Lincoln Park, and the next phone call, calls 10 and 11, are crucial. Jay Wilds tells you that as they're entering the park, preparing to bury the body of Haley, Jennifer Pusateri returns the call. She returns the call because the message is confusing. She knows the cell phone number because it's on her caller ID, so she calls the cell phone. Jay doesn't answer. Jennifer tells you that someone else answered and said Jay's busy right now, he'll call you back. Jennifer Pusateri spoke to the detectives before Jay Wilds did, yet Jay Wilds tells you about the exact same phone call. While we were there, Jennifer called. The defendant told her I was busy. That call, ladies and gentlemen, at 7:09 or 7:16 p.m., occurred in the cell phone area covered by Lincoln Park. That call is consistent with everything the witnesses told you.
Later, we can see that the other prosecutor on the case, Kevin Urich, made a similar argument in his rebuttal closing, also noting how the Lincoln Park pings destroyed Adnan's potential mosque alibi. So according to Urich, the defense tells you, well, they can't place you specifically within any place by this. Absolutely true, but look at the 709 and 716, 689B, which is the Lincoln Park coverage area. There's a witness who says they were in Lincoln Park. If the cell coverage area comes back as that, that includes Lincoln Park. That is reasonable circumstantial evidence that you can use to say they were in Lincoln Park. You've got it two ways, through the cell phone records, through the witness testimony, the two mesh together. And notice again, the cell phone is nowhere near the mosque, which would be at the corner of Johnny Cake and Rolling Road, which is over there, which is right near the defendant's house too. That cell phone is way downtown at 689B. That's another inference from which you can say the defendant was not at the mosque.
In his interview with The Intercept, Urich said two things very similar to what he argued at trial. The first, of course, is a statement that Jay's testimony by itself, would that have been proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Probably not. Cell phone evidence by itself? Probably not. This is consistent with the state's arguments all along about the crucial nature of the Lincoln Park phone calls. It's also consistent with what happened after Adnan's first trial. You might recall that the jurors at the first trial had heard all of the state's case except for the cell tower evidence and the testimony from Jen. The jury had not even heard any of Adnan's defense or any of his witnesses. Nevertheless, a majority of his jurors would not have found Adnan guilty.
Then there's the second thing that Urich said. I was just looking through his Intercept interview again, and I was shocked because I didn't realize he had made this claim. But again, it's very consistent with what he said during his rebuttal closing. According to The Intercept, early on in the case, Urich said the defense sent a disclosure to the state saying it had more than 80 witnesses who would testify about Adnan's whereabouts on the day he allegedly killed Hay and buried her body. But when the defense found out that the cell phone record showed that Adnan was nowhere near the mosque, it killed that alibi, and those witnesses were never called to testify at the trial. Now, Susan, I find this fascinating. And again, as I've said, it's entirely consistent with Urich's arguments during closing. Jay's claim, once again, is that Adnan and he were burying Hay's body in Lincoln Park from about 7:09 p.m. to 7:45 p.m. on January 13th. And this claim was corroborated at trial by the state based upon the incoming calls that pinged the L689B tower at 7:09 and 7:16 p.m. But this is that second part of the argument. According to Urich, these pings were not only used to corroborate Jay's story, they also functionally prevented Gutierrez from possibly calling 70 or more alibi witnesses from Adnan's mosque who could have testified potentially that they saw Adnan at the mosque on January 13th at some point during this key time frame between 7:09 and 7:45 p.m. So based upon that, you know, if the state had disclosed that Exhibit 31 was a subscriber activity report, allowing Gutierrez to challenge, likely successfully, the admissibility of the incoming Lincoln Park pings, A, the state's case would have been a lot weaker. We wouldn't have corroboration of Jay's claims about being in Lincoln Park. But B, the defense case possibly could have been much stronger because, you know, according to the state itself, it was those pings, those incoming pings, that bolstered Jay's story and destroyed the alibi. And so, you know, according to well-settled Maryland precedent, we should take the state at its word.
Yeah, I don't see there ever being a problem here in showing materiality. These records were the heart of the state's case. They were the only thing that showed that Jay was even plausibly telling the truth. The only thing that could actually support any of his claims, because the rest were based on his word and no more. So in terms of a Brady claim, the materiality is a slam dunk. A few more points. The first two come again from the Ware case, which makes clear that Brady applies irrespective of the good or bad faith of the state. This means that the first page of the subscriber activity report could have been withheld with the best or the worst intentions, and it wouldn't matter. If the state simply lost the page or never saw it or misplaced it, or if the state intentionally took it out of the file and made sure Exhibit 31 didn't include it, that doesn't matter. The fact that it didn't get to the defense is all that matters in evaluating this part of Brady. Second, the court in Ware again cited to Kyles v. Whitley for the definition of when undisclosed evidence is material, thus requiring a new trial. This language here clarifies why I think it's so clear that the materiality prong of the Brady test is met. The touchstone of materiality is a reasonable probability of a different result, and the adjective is important. The question is not whether the defendant was more likely than not to have received a different verdict with the evidence, but whether in its absence, the defendant would have received a fair trial, understood as a trial resulting in a verdict worthy of confidence. A reasonable probability of a different result is accordingly shown when the government's evidence suppression undermines confidence in the outcome of the trial. So you don't have to believe that there likely would have been an acquittal or even a hung jury if the state turned over the first page of the Exhibit 31 document. You simply have to believe that the state's failure to turn over the evidence and Gutierrez's resulting inability to have the incoming calls deemed admissible deprived Adnan of a fair trial. And in case you're wondering, the court shouldn't just look at what Gutierrez would have done with the evidence. As the Court of Appeals of Maryland noted in the State v. Williams, another case we've also covered in previous episodes, the caliber of the defense counsel's performance in cross-examining the critical state's witness has little, if any, bearing on materiality. We certainly are not inclined to make the test of materiality of undisclosed evidence depend on the capability or actual performance of opposing counsel in conducting cross-examination of an adverse witness. This case addresses the duty of the state, a duty that is not discharged no matter how well a defendant's counsel handles the client's defense and how expertly he or she endeavors to neutralize damaging evidence. Engaging the non-disclosure in terms of due process, the focus must be on the essential fairness of the procedures and not on the astuteness of either counsel.
Yeah, so again, we are simply left with the question of whether this evidence that the state failed to disclose was material and whether it deprived Adnan of a fair trial. Now, if this hearing on Adnan's case were even a few months ago, the court very well would have been entitled to reach its own conclusion without any on-point precedent. That all changed, however, on July 6th of this year. That was the day on which the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland issued its opinion in Baker versus State. Let's look first at the facts of that case. In the Baker case, the victim, known as AO, who was a prostitute, claimed that she had been raped by the defendant after refusing to agree to sexual acts without a condom. The victim later told others about this rape and eventually identified the defendant out of a photo array and from the witness stand at trial. Now, the main evidence that corroborated the victim's story was cell phone records, and those records indicated the defendant had called the victim on the night in question. At trial, though, the state failed to properly authenticate those cell phone records. They failed to satisfy the rules of evidence, meaning they should have never been admitted or seen by the jury, much like the claim we're making about the incoming pings in Adnan's case. So this left for the appellate court the question of whether the improper admission of those records was harmless or prejudicial error, which is an analysis that's very similar to the materiality analysis under Brady. This is made very clear by the defense counsel's brief in the case, which focused upon what the prosecution argued during closing arguments. So according to the brief, The phone records and testimony based on them were incredibly prejudicial to Mr. Baker, and admitting them was not harmless error. Aside from AO's identification, no other evidence connected Mr. Baker to her, and the state relied heavily on the records to link the two of them on the night of the incident. The prosecutor opened his closing argument by saying, July 18th, 2013, at 8:45 p.m., Michael Baker dialed AO's Google number. He went on to argue that Mr. Baker dialed the number several times that night and had no explanation for it. The prosecutor then used the phone record several times during closing to argue that they confirmed AO's story and that they undercut Mr. Baker's alibi. He returns the records again at the end of the closing and during rebuttal closing. The phone records were the centerpiece and recurring theme of the state's argument to the jury. Given the weakness of the state's case and its reliance on the phone records, the erroneous introduction of the evidence in the phone calls severely prejudiced Mr. Baker, this court cannot find the error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Court of Special Appeals of Maryland agreed, and as a result, they threw out his conviction, granted him a new trial. So summing up, this Baker case is very much like Adnan's case. We had one witness directly implicating the defendant. Prosecution relied heavily upon cell phone evidence during trial and eventually closing argument to corroborate that witness. Additionally, the prosecutors in both cases used that same cell phone evidence to argue against the alibis that the defendants presented or could have presented at trial. Therefore, it seems pretty easy to me, for the same reasons a new trial was granted in Baker, a new trial should be granted for Adnan. And even if you're not convinced by what I've argued so far, there are actually reasons to believe that Adnan has a stronger case than the defendant in Baker. In arguing against Baker getting a new trial, the Maryland Attorney General's office, the same AG's office that's handling Adnan's case, claimed that even without the cell phone evidence in Baker's trial, there was still enough evidence to allow his conviction to stay in the books. For example, in that case, there was evidence that Baker had falsified his time records to show he was at work on the night in question. There was also evidence that Baker, in fact, had asked a witness to lie on his behalf to the same effect. Maybe most importantly, Baker had asked his arresting officer, "I didn't think you could rape a prostitute. Isn't that an oxymoron?" And he later told him, "Come on, man, you know I'm innocent. It was a prostitute." So despite the fact that we have falsified records, alibi witness tampering, statements that look an awful lot like a confession, you know, evidence that's not there in Adnan's case, the court still find these cell phone records were so important, we need to have a new trial. That clearly indicates to me, if these cell phone pings were inadmissible, the cover sheet could have been used at a Fry hearing, that is certainly enough to find prejudice and materiality under Brady, and it's certainly enough for a new trial.
Yeah, and that's a horrible case that illustrates so perfectly what happens when the state doesn't do what it needs to be doing. Again, he is not acquitted. He gets a new trial. And this time, hopefully, the state will get its act together and properly authenticate cell phone records.
Yeah, I mean, the Baker case is not a case you look at and say, necessarily, we think Baker's innocent. It's not a case where you look at his actions and think this is an honorable person. It's exactly as you note, Susan. It's a case where the state failed in its obligations in that case to authenticate the records, in this case, to turn over the evidence that possibly could have been used to have Gutierrez argue against the incoming pings being admissible at trial.
The problem with the state's actions when it does this sort of thing, when it fails to properly authenticate evidence, when it fails to properly obtain evidence, the result is that the innocent get convicted and the guilty go free. Both are problems that result, and both have consequences. But like Baker, in this case, we have great confidence that if these records had been turned over to the defense, or if the defense had recognized the records and used them as it should have, the incoming calls would have been deemed inadmissible. And we know this because in this case, there was a third affidavit that was filed with the reply brief. And that's from Abraham Wernowitz, who was the state's expert at trial and who testified concerning the cell phone records and the cell phone locations based off Exhibit 31. Wernowitz has been working with Adnan's attorney. And according to Wernowitz, he considers this information to be crucial to his testimony, and he doesn't know why it was withheld from him. This means that the language of the cover letter would have been controlling at a Fry hearing. And as a result, the jurors never would have heard about the incoming pings. Accordingly, there's a reasonable probability that, as it happened at the first trial, the jury would have found Adnan not guilty once the cell phone records were excluded, or at least the incoming calls were excluded. If that's the case, the outcome is clear. Adnan's conviction is thrown out, and he gets a new trial.
Yeah, I mean, Susan, this is pretty much, from my perspective as an evidence professor, this is the gold standard. Having the actual expert for the prosecution at trial coming in an appeal and saying, yeah, I mean, this cover sheet would have governed. It said incoming pings are unreliable. That's the standard at a Frey hearing. Is the evidence reliable? If he's saying I can't disclaim that language, the language from AT&T says they're unreliable, it's a slam dunk. There's no way the judge would have allowed these incoming pings in to determine the location of the cell phone.
So we have the state in their brief arguing that Gutierrez could never have raised the cell phone cover sheet issue because she would have looked foolish and disingenuous, because the expert would have simply rebuffed her and said, no, it doesn't matter. These records are accurate. But that's not the case. The state was just assuming that. That was not something based on evidence or fact. That was conjecture on their part, which they presented as fact in their brief. In fact, the actual expert has made clear he did not know about it, doesn't know why he wasn't told about it. And if he had been asked about it at trial, he would have considered it relevant and important information, which would have prevented him from using incoming call records as a basis for determining possible location. This isn't some kind of technicality or some kind of irrelevant point. This is a big deal for factual reasons as well as legal ones. We still don't know why the cover sheet says what it does. And after talking to numerous RF experts and former AT&T employees, I still don't have a solid answer. It's clear that the concern for the reliability of incoming call records is real and maybe the result of multiple causes. The first issue is whether or not the data itself is accurate. Whether the numbers printed on that page, whether the cell site listings are themselves accurate data that matches the actual cell site that a call was made on. We know that the subscriber activity reports were billing records, not engineering records. And Wernerwitz's affidavit makes it clear that he had no experience with billing records. He didn't work with them. He didn't know what they did. He didn't know how they operated. He did not know how the information in the display was obtained or what rules were used to generate it. We do know, however, that AT&T's billing records were known to not always accurately reflect actual cell site data. As discussed in the case of California v. Zumot, which we went into in episode 8 of Undisclosed, AT&T had some kind of setting, perhaps for billing purposes, that could result in an incoming call's cell site reflecting not the cell site that the receiving phone was connected through during the call, but the cell site where the calling phone was connected through. So in other words, the location data might reflect the caller's location, not the receiver's location. The second issue is whether or not the incoming calls can be used to identify a possible geographical range for a phone. As in, that is to say, even if the data itself is right, even if the cell site listing actually matches the cell site the call was actually made on, it's possible that incoming calls do not connect on the strongest signal in the same way that outgoing calls do. Which would mean for Wernerwitz's testing, which determined only the single strongest signal for a given area, would be meaningless for estimating the location of a cell phone at the time of an incoming call. If that's what's going on with the AT&T records, then for an incoming call, the starting tower, which is the tower we have on the billing records, could just as easily have been the weakest signal in an area, not the strongest.
Not only basically would the state have to argue against its positions during closing arguments, on appeal, in interviews to The Intercept, they would basically at this point have to argue against their own expert witness at trial. I mean, everything that we have presented today isn't coming from us. It's coming from things the state itself and its own expert witnesses have argued. And again, everything here points to a new trial. This evidence, again, it bolstered the state's case. It significantly harmed the defense case. And it was all based upon this evidence that wasn't disclosed in 2000. It wasn't disclosed in 2015. The state's arguing there was no reason to argue it then, no reason to argue it now. This is a very strong Brady claim, and I will be really interested to see what the state tries to argue, because again, the only thing they can argue is an argument against their own prior positions.
Or perhaps an argument that Christina Gutierrez is ineffective. That's their escape from the Brady claim. They can always say, oh no, we did give her everything. She just failed to use it at trial. In which case, Anand should still be granted a new trial based on ineffectiveness. Because, again, if Gutierrez had this information, she was ineffective for not using it.
Many of you may not realize it, but like tens of millions of listeners across the world, I also had to wait every Thursday for the new Serial episode. I had no idea what would be coming next, what Sarah and her team had found, or even who they had spoken to. So each week I would wait anxiously and I would wonder about what they had to tell us next. And I remembered when they got to the episode about the Linkin Park pings, I also remember feeling like I had been hit in the gut when Dana concluded that the pings meant his phone was in Linkin Park that night. That was a really tough episode for me because from all of my research, I knew the expert said that it simply wasn't possible to locate a cell phone the way the state used the evidence. I knew that if we got a new trial, we would be able to exclude the cell tower pings as evidence because the science simply doesn't hold up. And yet, Serial had come to another conclusion. And that definitely it impacted my effort to show how hokey the state's case was to the public. But more importantly, it kept the cell tower evidence, and I say that in quotes, alive in the minds of people as a way to put Adnan in the park, despite Jay's changing stories. But now, that's all over. When the state's own witness comes forward to say, hey, no, it does not work like that, it is time to dispense with the nonsense. The cell tower pings are not evidence. A million different routes could be plotted using those pings, and they would all be possible, but they are never ever evidence of where Adnan actually was that night. There are no Linkin Park pings. There never were. Which leaves us, according to Yurik himself, with nothing but Jay's stories. But of course, there were other stories about where Adnan was on January 13th, and one very important one about where he was that night. But the state made sure that the story would never see the light of day at trial. Next time on Undisclosed. A special thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, and to Amar Naji, our sound editor. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us online on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @undisclosedpod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.